call the Education Finance Committee to order. And let's see, Representative Quam, would you like to move the minutes that are in your packet from February 11th?
After I thoroughly review them, I shall.
Thank you. Representative Quam so moves. Any questions, any discussion? All in favor of their adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. All right, so we've got four bills scheduled to be heard today. And I think, Representative Ansels, if you are ready, we will kick off with yours. House File 34. Let me put my glasses on, make sure I'm getting that right.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Representative Ansels. And so you would like to move House File 34 to be re-referred to Capital Investment Committee?
Yes, thank you.
And the intention of the chair is that we will lay it over at
thank
this time.
You.
But thank you for coming and bringing your testifier, and please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. I'm joined at the table here by one of those many great rural school superintendents that we all enjoy. From my community of Deer River, this is Mr. Matt Gross, who's the superintendent of schools for my community of Deer River. The proposal that you have before you has been around for a couple of bonding cycles. It is to construct with bond proceeds a multi-age service center, if you will, for the community of Deer River, which has a population of around 1,100 and a school population of around 900. This would be a facility located in my community, which is located on the western edge of Itasca County. It abuts up on the west to the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. It is an area of significant poverty. Representative Dabney, our free and reduced lunch number is 70%. The community, led by Superintendent Gross, sees this project as a unique opportunity to do much better with early childhood education, after school programs, and also to take advantage of the talents of a growing senior citizen population. This is a community where traditionally elders are important to youngsters in the mentoring process. This is a community where raising children is a community goal much stronger than just the traditional family setting. With that overview, if it's okay, I'd like to turn it over to Matt Gross, the school superintendent, who is in the point in putting this project together.
Thank you, Representative Ansel.
Welcome, Mr. Gross. If you please just say your name for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Gross. As Representative Ansel says, I'm the superintendent for Deer River Schools. We serve about 900 kids covering a district of 540 square miles, so it's very very diverse. Over 40% of the children in my district are American Indian. And also, we serve a community that is in what I would consider extreme poverty. Our school is a reflection of that community. We have a summer foods program. We served over 5,000 meals last year, free of charge, to children and adults. We have a pantry that's in our elementary school that basically serves as a food shelf because our community has that level of need. Associated and affiliated with a lot of that poverty is social, mental health, issues in the school, again, as a reflection of that, a reflection of the community. We've gone from about 2 mental health staff in the last 10 years to 6. And so there's significant needs. This project has come together over about 5 years, recognizing some needs that we have in our community. I think on the back of a handout that you have, there are some images of our current senior center that is probably nothing short of dilapidated. The front entrance is not ADA compliant, and it's, in my opinion, an embarrassment of how we're supposed to take care of our seniors. Along with that, we've tried to do a good job, and I believe it's important in our community to wrap around care for our kids. So our after-school program has turned out to be very successful, and we're in a position now where it's essentially fishbowl. We can't serve any more kids because of the physical space that we're donating in kind to the Boys and Girls Club. So we have a lot of partners involved and interested. Community Cafe serves over 150 meals a night to our community. Again, a reflection of our community's need. They would be a strong partner in this. And then Representative Anzels mentioned early childhood. We have a shortage of daycare in our community, a significant shortage, and I can speak of that personally with a preschooler of my own. And this facility would enable our community to, or have our community's needs met when it comes to early childhood as well. So far, we've identified a building that could potentially host this space, and it's reflected in the handout. It's over 44,000 square feet, and it's a former warehouse that used to serve a thriving timber and lumber business in town, and has long since gone or come to hard times. And so right now it's a symbol of better times, and I think this also would be an opportunity to revitalize that the community by restoring that space into something positive and productive. This space would also meet needs around after school or youth sports activities and community gathering space. Currently, there isn't any kind of a facility to hold large community events, and business owners in our community are looking for ways to expand that, and they voiced that in a recent meeting we had with our Chamber of Commerce. We've also met with the City Council and had them identify what they feel are our community's biggest needs, and what they identified as our biggest community needs were precisely what this project reflects, which was taking care of our aging population as well as our youngest kids.
I think I have at least one question, maybe a couple from committee members. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And noticing the age cutoff on your materials that were given to the committee, I assume the centennials have separate but equal facilities?
Mr. Gross or Representative Anzels, whoever wants to take it.
Madam Chair, thanks. The facility would have facilities accessible from to our earliest learners in early childhood program, as well as a senior center that would incorporate community or computer facilities, reading facilities, eating facilities, and community fitness as well.
Representative Quam. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Anzels, for bringing this forward. Superintendent Grouse, you seem to be a very cooperative and forward-thinking superintendent who's not afraid to think outside the box, and I appreciate that. I like the look on the Boys and Girls Club in the early childhood, so thank you for bringing that forward. I appreciate the opportunity. I look forward to supporting. I just have one process question, and that is, why are you not going to a local bond referendum, and why are you running through the capital investment process? And like I said, I look forward to supporting it, but I just wanted to know what I was missing there.
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair and committee members. I believe that the bonding would just be a component of the funding required to pull this project off. We would have to couple or tether bonding with partner support. We've had good conversations with places like the Blandon Foundation, and we're working in cooperation with the tribe, for example. But we're also going to have to go to our voters at some point, because it's going to take a real cooperative effort. And to your question, I'm sorry if I can defer back. To your question, as I processed, there would be facilities that would be equal across the board. So, yes, everybody. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't answer that before.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you for that, Superintendent. And I really do appreciate you're pulling a lot of things together. I know the Boys and Girls Club. I know the American Indian population. I know Eric. So thank you. I think it's a great idea.
And Madam Chair and Representative Precia, if I may, this project would be easier if this community were located within the taconite relief area and thus eligible for taconite production tax, infrastructure, human capital investments, and all of that. It, unfortunately, it is not. So this is going to be a more rigorous battle here.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gross, who owns the building now that you are planning on using?
Sure.
Mr. Gross.
Madam Chair, thank you. The building currently is owned by two private, two brothers that are in business together. And part of the building is currently leased commercially, and that would continue.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gross, has this building been for sale for a period of time?
Mr. Gross.
Madam Chair, thank you. The building is not publicly listed, but I've been working with these owners for about 2.5 years because they have a desire to do something with the building, I think, for their own personal interests, but also I think they recognize, having done some development in the city similar for youth, that there's the potential for something good to come out.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gross, I appreciate that the deal hasn't been made, but how much money would these two brothers be receiving for the sale or lease of this building?
Mr. Gross.
Madam Chair, thank you. We have a preliminary quote from them, but we haven't gotten to the point of negotiations with them for the purchase price of the facility. We have an estimate, but because we haven't got to a point where we're able to be serious about those negotiations, we haven't had significant conversations yet.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Mr. Murphy.
Madam Chair, this is a finance committee, and that's why I'm asking these questions in particular. I would like to know, you're asking for $2.9 million, about how much of that would go for the acquiring the building, how much would go for the pre-design and the design, and how much would, and then we have to do all that before we can get this wonderful programming and this partnership with for the good of people. So if you could give more particulars on what the 2.9 will buy.
Mr. Gross.
Madam Chair, thank you. The estimate or the conversations that I've had with the individuals involved or the owners of the building, their price is $1.6 million. The cost at this point is estimated as of yesterday to be $6.3 million for total cost on the project. And Representative Murphy, if I can have a little bit of deference, that one of the conversations, or I think a particular note, is that the school district could meet its needs without trying to do something of this significance for the community. But our community and I think the people involved, like myself, believe that the opportunity here is too great to pass up, not trying to do something significant outside of just bottling up and taking care of our pre-K-12 needs.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions were kind of following along the line of Representative Murphy's. And when I just did the preliminary math, I guess, you know, I'd be interested in being this as a finance committee, learning a little bit more. You mentioned that the building was dilapidated, but yet there's tenants. You know, is this, if there's a leasing of the building and that was going to continue, it's suggesting to me that you perhaps don't need all of that space for the activity in which the school is concerned about it. I would be a little concerned about taking that property off of the tax rolls, which is you know, a net benefit for your small town. And looking at the $2.9 million, you could build quite a bit of square feet for the $2.9 million and have an energy-efficient building that is going to be best suited for the taxpayers long-term than what potentially could be a rabbit hole for reoccurring expenses and maintenance, as you described initially the building as being old. I'm in commercial and residential real estate, and the price that you're talking about, if you divided the request into the square footage, is $65 a square foot. The price you later quoted upon Representative Murphy's questions brought that price down substantially. But I don't have deference to telling you what you should or shouldn't be doing, but I guess I would take that into consideration in terms of a funding request and whether or not it really is in the best interest of the taxpayers to build a new building of smaller square footage to serve the purpose in which you're seeking, rather than using school financing for a redevelopment purpose, which it sounds a little bit like what it is.
Mr. Gross, did you want to comment? Or?
Sure, Madam Chair. Thank you for those comments. I think there's a couple things that I probably neglected to mention in the course of my testimony. The first is that on the back of one of the sheets that you have, it indicates in the lower right of the current facility where the renovated space is. So currently, where the lease is, there's renovated space. So a business, auto parts business, has determined that with renovation, the space is justifiable as a business. In regards to the square foot price, we're talking about obviously a very, very large building. It's 44,000 square feet, which if you're talking about educational space in kindergarten and early childhood rooms, best practice for kindergarten rooms in that size is well over 1,000 square feet per room. So our current, in order to expand and meet our shortage in child care, we need a significant number of rooms. And if you look at the drawing on the back, the initial rendering, about half of the space is dedicated to early childhood. The prices that we're getting estimates for new construction are well over $200 a square foot, and so there, it doesn't seem to me mathematically that we could construct a facility of this size meeting these needs for that amount of money. Could the project be scaled down into something different? Absolutely it could, and we could potentially look at adding space somewhere else in the community, but I don't see how it could meet the multi-aspected needs represented in the proposal that was put forward.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Gross, in your comments, you talked about, I think you said, a once thriving lumber industry. Could you talk about that a little bit more in terms of what's kind of happened, jobs lost, jobs left up there in your immediate area?
Sure.
Mr. Gross.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Representative Anzels indicated, geographically we're located, actually about a third of my school district is Leech Lake Indian Reservation. To our east is the Iron Range. Our community has, over time, survived off of resorts and timber. And as of late, the timber industry hasn't had a very good go of it. If you've been on Highway 2, to the west of town is a big compound called Ryla Lumber. And when the housing industry was in good shape, they were very successful in marketing high-quality wood products because of the drying process that they used. And this facility that has been identified preliminarily was one of the places that they made veneer. And there's a building adjacent, maybe a quarter mile away, similar, that they're still operating to some degree some veneer production. But at this point, there's no production whatsoever going on in the facility.
Representative Anderson. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification on what Representative Hertas asked. Mr. Gross, do I remember hearing you say that your school is at capacity?
Mr. Gross.
Madam Chair, yes. Our King Elementary School is currently actually probably past capacity.
So,
Representative Murphy.
It's the Madam Chair. that, Mr. Gross, then you do need some kind of outside space if you have any growth whatsoever for your elementary school.
Mr. Gross.
Children, or in numbers.
Madam Chair and committee members, yes. The regardless of whether this project moves forward, there's going to have to be a change in how we're, what our facilities look like in Deer River. If a facility like this became available, we would shift our early childhood that currently sits in our elementary, as well as early childhood that sits in another site about a half a mile north of town in the hospital. We'd be able to aggregate all of our early childhood programming into one place, and that would free up space in our elementary school.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Gross. And you said that you had... Have you had survey of other spaces in the community for your community center or multi-age center, or was this the only one that you've looked at?
Mr. Gross.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. There are, when we met with the Chamber of Commerce most recently and also the City Council, we had a conversation about tax impact to Representative Hertas's question, as well as other available facilities. And in terms of renovation, there aren't any facilities in town that would meet this particular need. There is a vacant lot south of one of our hotels that would be big enough to construct new. But again, back to the cost of new construction, it would well exceed what we would be able to do, I believe, and at least the advisors that we've been working with and have engaged with have recommended.
Representative Murphy. All right. Any other questions from committee members? All right. Is there anyone in the public or in the audience who wishes to offer any other testimony on this bill? I don't see any, so... with that, Representative Anzels.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for your indulgence. I would just say to you the converging issues of poverty and the myriad of family and social issues that are attached to poverty, along with our commitment to our youngsters and all of the efforts that we're putting into early childhood in greater Minnesota, the challenges are many to actually implement all of the vision that we spend so much time talking about because of the pure inability to put facilities together, to put space together, and to manage these programs in a way in which we as legislators envision this stuff happening statewide, regardless of where you live or how much money you have. So thank you for your time. I sincerely appreciate it. And I want to publicly mention to you that to demonstrate the commitment to the project, Mr. Gross, who's a very, very busy person, you know, it took him 4.5 hours to drive here to spend time with you, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Anzels, and thank you to Mr. Gross and your commitment not only to the children in your charge, but your community is commendable. We appreciate all the time you've taken to be here with us today.
Thank you.
And with that, Representative Anzels renews his motion.
Yes.
And it is the chair's intent again to lay this over.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. And then, you know, if the remaining members, we've got three other bills. If you want to flip a coin or draw straws or whoever wants to go first or if anyone has other committee commitments. I'm going to make you choose among you who wants to go next. Looks like it's Representative Purcell. And I'm taking the opportunity to give some of our newest members of the committee an opportunity to chair. So if Representative Bennett would like to come forward and take the gavel. Representative Murphy.
Before that happens, Madam Chair, do you have any idea how bonding proposals are going to be handled?
Thank you, Representative.
Like this one came in this committee now? Do we make a series, or do we hear all the bonding proposals that might have to do with education finance and then forward recommendations in priority order, or just forward all projects to the bonding committee?
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Well, as you know, as being a new chair, we're still kind of sorting through this, but it would be my intention at this point that we will hear the bonding proposals that come through this that have an education finance component. Obviously, that's why they're here. And then at some point, we will bring those back before the committee and vote on recommendations. I haven't decided yet if we're going to prioritize those or what, but yes, we will be coming back and sending recommendations on to the Capital Investment Committee.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Benefit, if you want to come up.
Okay, the chair would now like to bring HF319 before the committee. The chair moves HF319 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, but it will be the chair's intention to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further consideration at a later date. So the chair now recognizes Representative Purcell to explain the bill and to introduce the testifier to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity and hearing the bill today. This House File 319 is we had this bill last year and were able to secure $50,000 of one-time money, and we're back here to try and get this built into the budget. $50,000 a year for a couple of years here, and I have with me the director of the Headwaters Science Center in Bemidji, Ms. Susan Joy, and she's going to explain a little bit about what was done in the past year and ongoing with the funding that was received, and what the intent is for this funding if we're able to secure that moving ahead. So I'd like to have Ms. Joy give her testimony at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Joy. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairwoman Bennett and members of this committee. My name is Susan Joy. I'm the director of the Headwaters Science Center. The $50,000 that was granted through an appropriation in the Minnesota Department of Education, we currently use that money for four different goals that we have at the Headwaters Science Center. We have a science club that we currently have after school in Bemidji that we expanded this year to the community of Black Duck, which is 25 miles north of Bemidji. We hosted a New Year's Eve party for the community that was a maker event. And if you're familiar with the maker movement, it's all about encouraging people, children, youth, adults to make rather than consume, to be inventors. We have ongoing work with hosting field trips and performing outreach programs, developing our capacity to do more, to provide more STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, education opportunities. And finally, we're offering professional development to educators, both in public school, charter schools, private schools, homeschools, around earth science, and possibly some aquatic invasive species education for educators. At the Headwaters Science Center, we serve a large region, as indicated in your handout and also in the full map here from Representative Purcell. We serve a very rural part of Minnesota, a very low-income part of Minnesota. 15 counties are currently served by the Headwaters Science Center, whether we go to a school and provide education or they come to us. We do not believe that geography or location should be a barrier to opportunity for any child in this state, whether they live in International Falls or right here in the metro area. Access to opportunity is important for future goals. Unfortunately, this room doesn't have windows, but I think if it did, you would be able to see outside and see the renovations happening across the street, where science is in action with things like simple machines, pulleys, levers, block and tackle. Science is all around us everywhere, and I know you'll hear from other people today who are talking about that, but our job at the Headwaters Science Center is not to tell people what to think about science, but to give them tools and help them become informed and scientifically literate citizens. That's what the future economic realities of our communities, our state, and our nation require. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Stand for any questions now, please.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Joy, what is the total budget of the Headwaters Science Center?
Our, excuse me, Chairperson Bennett and members of the committee, our 2015 operating budget is $275,000. I have 9 full-time staff, and we operate a science center that's approximately 27,000 square feet that we own in downtown Bemidji.
Representative Murphy, did you want to add to that? Okay. Representative Depper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for the testimony here. What percentage of your operating budget is funded through grants, state grants?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, approximately 15% of my overall budget is funded by grants, and of that 15%, we have a surface water assessment grant through the Minnesota Pollution Control Authority, in addition to this grant from the Minnesota Department of Education, that makes up the majority of that 15%. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mr. Strom. Aside from the $50,000 last year, haven't we provided for this museum before when we've done museums?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, to my knowledge, last year was the first year we ever appropriated money for Headwaters. Ms. Johnson has put together a very nice chart for you, but to my knowledge, at least out of the K-12 portion of the budget, last year was the first year ever for Headwaters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps Representative Purcell knows.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I believe that information is correct. I wanted to add to it that the Headwaters Science Center, and I'm going to start this out, I may need some additional information from Ms. Joy, is connected with the Science Museum of Minnesota, but we don't get any funding up there through that same funding stream.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Ms. Johnson, do you want to add something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, after I completed this, I noticed in FY 12 and 13 there were some clean water legacy funds that went to them in the ballpark of about $25,000 each year. So I think that may be what you're speaking to.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Representative Erickson, anything else?
Well, no, it's just that this is a great little place in Bemidji. I've been there, that and the Children's Museum and the Science Museum, both of those in St. Paul, lend all of our constituents who live close to the Twin Cities an opportunity to experience this. And this one happens to be in the far north, and it's really a neat little place. Thank you for coming.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thank you for the map and the legend that gives us an idea. I'm just wondering some details because of the distance from some of the cities marked for school groups. Is there an overnight experience that's involved in some of these school groups that come?
Chairwoman Bennett, Representative
yes.
Palm. We do offer overnight experiences for Girl Scouts. It's part of something that their troops elect to do. We recognize that there is great distance that some of these school groups do travel. Typically, if a group is coming from 2 hours away, say International Falls or the Fargo-Moorhead area, they will most likely board their buses at 7 in the morning, arrive at the Science Center when we open at 9:30, stay, eat lunch, get back on the bus, and go home. And if I may speak to Representative Purcell, the Headwaters Science Center is not associated with the Science Museum of Minnesota as if we were part of them, but we belong to a 350-plus member organization called the Association of Science and Technology Centers, which we offer reciprocal admission between museums, not only in Minnesota, but across the country and the world. Thank you for the question.
Representative Kwan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You indicate Minneapolis as being a school group location, and seeing that that would be slightly more than 2 hours, I'm just curious of what's entailed for those school groups and the accessibility.
Ms. Joy?
Can I?
Or Representative Purcell?
You correct me if I'm wrong, Madam Chair. Representative, I think that's on there just as a frame of reference.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, I have one last question. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Ms. Joy. Do you have any relations with Bemidji State University? Do you get any support through the college there?
Ms. Joy?
Chairwoman Bennett, members of the committee. We do not receive funding from Bemidji State University. We have a wonderful relationship with many professors, including board members who are also professors at the university, and we host teacher education programs and include their pre-service teachers. But no, we do not receive any funding from Bemidji State University.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Members, any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this funding were approved, Representative Purcell, or maybe to our research staff, would this become part of the education, the baseline funding?
Representative Purcell.
That would be our hope, that we're going to get into a funding stream in the general fund, Representative Anderson. Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Members, any other questions? Okay, would anybody else in the audience like to testify? Representative Murphy.
One more question for Ms. Joy, or Representative Purcell. Do you do any work with public television stations and the education programs that they have started to develop?
Chairwoman Bennett, members of the committee. Our association with Lakeland Public Television would be that if we have a new exhibit or a program or a special happening, they'll come over and do a story. We've been featured on their series Common Ground, but at this point we do not provide programming through Lakeland Public Television or a local public access station. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Ms. Joy. Anybody else, members? Okay. Oh, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Representative Bennett, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, and maybe you can clarify this, Representative Purcell. When this museum received those legacy dollars, under what argument or persuasion were they received? Because, you know, using legacy dollars for something like this, to me, makes such great sense. But do you remember under what the argument was to convince? Or maybe
Ms. Johnson knows.
That's a good question, and I'm going to defer to Ms. Joy, if you remember
Joy,
that.
Sorry.
Chairwoman Bennett, Representative Erickson, the surface water assessment grant that we have through legacy funding is a grant that we applied for through the Minnesota Pollution Control Authority. Nice. So it was a request for proposal that we submitted for, and we are currently working on finalizing a contract for another surface water assessment grant in Aiken County for fiscal year 16 and I believe 17.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Joy, that's not a project, though, that the children participate in, is it?
Ms. Joy?
Chairwoman Bennett, Representative Erickson. We work with Boganegishe School.
Yes.
And Trek North High School to involve youth in hands-on science opportunities.
Yes.
That offer a little career development. So, yes, we do take teens out on sampling runs with their teachers in the summer when it's safe and have them participate in this very important project with us. Thank you for the question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. That's very informative. And I'm wondering, because part of your emphasis is in STEM, has that then encouraged some of those young people to pursue college education based on STEM or even to take some of those courses at the high school level? Do you know?
Ms. Joy?
Chairwoman Bennett, Representative Erickson, I do not know. It would be my hope that would be the spark, mm-hmm. but I do not know.
Yeah, thanks. I hope it is a spark. That's great.
Okay, well, hearing no further witnesses, is there any further discussion on HF 319? Okay, I'd just like to add one thing, if I could. It excites me to hear about a science center as a teacher, and I anytime my students get hands-on science, their eyes just light up. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your presentation, and Representative Purcell, too. Representative Purcell, would you like to make any closing comments?
Just thank you all for your consideration, and renew the motion, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. We're hearing no further discussion. The chair lays over House File 319 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later date. Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you.
All right, well, welcome, Representative Bly. And we are going to move for you House File 557. And it will be referred to Ways and Means, but it would be my intention to hold it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And with that, welcome, and please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Loon. And I do have some testifiers with me, Gene Piccolo from MAX, and then I have two directors from local charter schools in my district who can speak to things. I just would like to say that they represent two charter schools that are very excellent schools and have good relationships with the Northfield School District, and the community is very proud to have them in our community. And the gist of this bill is to take the small schools revenue that was passed into law in 2011 and apply that to some charter schools so that that same sort of logic could be applied to them and they can get some additional revenue. And I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Piccolo here to kind of explain the rationale behind it all. There is mention of the Crosswinds School, and I may refer to Tim Strom to explain why that's a necessity in the bill. So.
Mr. Piccolo, welcome. If you want to state your name officially for the record, and we look forward to what you have to say.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly in support of House File 557, which would provide small school revenue to eligible charter schools in the same manner as small traditional school districts receive this revenue. The concept of small school revenue seems to have first been introduced as a public policy idea back in 2000 in a report from the Center for Rural Policy and Development at Mankato State University. The report pointed out, while it's recognized in business that cost is not directly proportional to quantity, this concept is not recognized in education. In other words, when it comes to schools, small schools face the same cost for unfunded mandates, compliance issues, and even basic programs and services as larger school districts or schools. But given their smaller student population, the costs are spread over a smaller number of pupils, or if you think of it in terms of business standpoint, a smaller customer base. The result is a higher per pupil expenditure for those costs in smaller schools and districts compared to larger districts and schools. So small school revenue was a way to recognize the reality that costs are different for small schools compared to larger schools. As was mentioned, in 2011, the legislature enacted sliding scale small school revenue formula for traditional school districts with enrollments of under 960 students as a means of recognizing these costs are not directly proportional between small and large schools. Approximately 45% of school districts receive some small school aid under the sliding scale formula. This bill would acknowledge that small charter schools face the same cost issues as small school districts in the state and provide those schools with an enrollment under 200 with small school revenue on a sliding school basis. About 45% of charter schools would receive some small school revenue under this formula because about 45% of them have under 200 students in their school. The effect of this legislation would be to provide more equitable funding for small schools in rural parts of the state, where we have a number of elementary schools that are smaller schools, and in the metro area for high schools that serve at-risk populations, which have smaller populations, and for schools in their formative years as they grow their grades and enrollment. We urge your support for House File 557 as a means of providing greater equity for small public charter schools. Thank you.
And Representative Lye, did you want to have Mr. Strom explain?
Yes, if he could speak to the mention of crosswinds in the bill, that would be helpful, I think, for members to understand why it's mentioned.
Madam Chair, committee members, last year the Crosswind School, which was a program operated by the East Metro Integration District, along with the Harambe School, were spun off from that organization. And Crosswinds is now an independently operated school by the Purpich Center, but its funding is specified in Chapter 129C. It's not really funded in the same manner as all school districts because it's not a school district, and it's not funded in the same manner as charter schools because it's not a charter school. So instead, in Chapter 129C, there's a section that determines how its general education flows to it.
Thank you for that suggestion. I think that is helpful. So, do you have another testifier?
Yeah, and then if I could have Simon Tyler from Prairie Creek School speak a little bit about how this might come up.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself, and we welcome your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Simon Tyler. I'm the director of Prairie Creek Community School. We're a small child-centered charter school serving children in kindergarten through fifth grade just outside Northfield. We're authorized by the Northfield School District, and as Representative Blythe said, we have strong positive relationships with that school district. We're careful stewards of the funds we receive from the state. We've been a charter school since 2002. We always forecast financially 5 years ahead and maintain a healthy fund balance. We're committed to educating children under the charter school law in an innovative, progressive way. We seek to educate children to have a capacity to think critically, be creative, and develop the habits of mind and lifelong learning skills that will assist them in being well-prepared citizens for the 21st century. Increasingly, we're finding the cost of meeting all the educational needs of maintaining our small classroom setting is a strain on our financial resources. In part, this is because we are very responsible about being responsive to public school accountability mandates that apply to charter schools as well as traditional public schools. These are initiatives such as Reading Well by Third Grade, World's Best Workforce, school safety programs, and, of course, the rapidly changing world of technology. We're also wanting to be very responsive to the changing physical and emotional requirements of serving young children. As part of our responses mandates, we've hired additional support staff for reading and math interventions, updated our technology, installed new security systems, and hired a part-time nurse. These are all good, very important initiatives to serve children, but they place a strong demand financially on the infrastructure of a small school budget. Under this bill, we would be looking to receive somewhere in the region of just under $10,000 for a school our size. That would be a relatively small pot of money, but would make a big difference to our programming and financial forecasting. It would help us invest in technology to support students who are increasingly doing more of their research and project work on laptops, iPads, and smart board. It would enable us to build on projects we've undertaken recently around robotics studies for children and Khan Academy math programs. Additionally, it would help us invest in the technology infrastructure we need to respond to public school mandates to administer the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments in third through fifth grade on online assessment materials only, which will be coming into effect this year for all schools. And we're also budgeting to make sustainable positions for intervention teachers and health professionals, as their work is essential to our child-centered program. And just as an example, $9,000 approximately covers the cost of about one-third of an intervention reading specialist or a school nurse. I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler.
I also have Ryan Kaminga here from Arcadia School.
Welcome, and please introduce yourself, and I might ask you to spell that just so we get it correct for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ryan Kraminga. It's K-R-O-M-I-N-G-A. I'm the Executive Director at Arcadia Charter School. Thank you for letting me come to testify on House File 557. Arcadia Charter School is a middle and high school program in Northfield, Minnesota. So we have grades 6 through 12. We're authorized by the Northfield School District. We have a focus in project-based learning. And funding like this can impact directly to our students through equipment, infrastructure, student-to-teacher ratio, reducing that class size has a giant impact for us. When we look at, as Simon had mentioned, with infrastructure in testing, just as an example, Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments are moving to all online, and so we look at the computers that we have available, a number of classroom laptop carts where we'll take weeks, 5+ weeks, to get through testing just because of our size. We have about 120 students, and then we'll be using that for testing, and then that also then is taken away from the classroom as those are being used for testing. So this can have a direct impact for us on students and their curriculum. For us, the funding formula would be about $22,000 to Arcadia, and that would have an immense impact for us on a number of things. But mainly within technology and within curriculum. Thank you.
Thank you.
That will stand for questions.
All right, thank you. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bly, I really do agree with the concept of either redirecting or reappropriating or using some of these various formulas to generate more revenue per student for small charter schools. My question is, did you look at any other funding streams or any other ways of directing more money to small charters other than this a funding stream? Because this funding stream, as I recall it, was originally thought of as a way to help small rural districts in greater Minnesota. And now we would be kind of redirecting the mission of all of that and directing these dollars towards small charters, which is good, but might these be small charters in the metropolitan area, which are part of districts that have much better tax bases than we do in greater Minnesota?
Representative Bly. You want to take that one?
I'm going to defer to Mr. Piccolo because Mr. Piccolo brought the bill to us, and I don't know whether or not other budget were looked at, so if you could respond.
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Enzel, we did look at different formulas on how to address this issue of small schools. The only categorical aid there is, a revenue source that deals with small schools, is this category. And we did look at several different options in terms of how to do this. If you look at the numbers, about a third of the schools are in very rural areas. There's three schools, for example, in Cook County that would qualify, and so forth. And the ones in the metro area are mostly high schools that have very small enrollments because they're serving at-risk students. And charter schools do not get any, you know, tax base from the local property tax. So therefore, this was the only kind of category that actually fit to do this.
Representative Anzels.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Bly, that your testifier mentioned at-risk kids sort of helps me out. Thanks.
Let's see. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a short series of questions for the testifiers, and I bet you can guess the first one.
I think I can, I'll hold my breath and see if I'm right.
All right. It's always the build-up. I'm wondering if the two gentlemen from the two charter schools could come down.
How many homeless and what's the poverty rate? Yeah.
There's a tension between consistency and, I don't know, something else, and I'm walking that tension. Gentlemen, would you please identify for the committee the percentage of your students who qualify as special education, the percentage who qualify for free lunch, the percentage that qualify for reduced price lunch, and the percentage that qualify as homeless or highly mobile for us, please.
Mr. Remington? Or Mr. Tyler, whoever wants to take that one first.
Madam Chair, I'll start. I don't have the exact percentages with me, committee member, and I can get those to you immediately after this. Our approximate numbers from last year's data were just under 20% special education, about 15% free and reduced lunch, and 0% homeless. And I'll be happy to furnish exact numbers from last year's annual report.
All right, thank you, Mr. Tyler.
Madam Chair, for homeless, we run zero. We have 0% with homeless. We have about a quarter of our population on free and reduced lunch. And we run between 35% and 40% for special education.
Wow.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. That was helpful. I think Mr. Piccolo, I was confused about your initial statement because charter schools were developed with the concept, relieve us from a bunch of the mandates, we can do better for less money. And that's been the promise. And yet you testified that charter schools have the same costs to school mandates as traditional publics, but they don't have as many mandates. So how can the costs for mandates that you don't have be the same as the costs for traditional publics that carry a much heavier load of mandates?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, if you look at the terms of mandates over the years, the number of mandates has increased every year on charter schools just as they have on traditional districts. In fact, if you look just in health and safety over the years, those have increased and we get no funding for health and safety levies and so forth. And there's at least 48 health and safety mandates that we've identified that schools have to comply with. We do have to comply with world's best workforce and all the academic requirements of the state of Minnesota. The only area where charter schools really have some significant freedom anymore in terms of autonomy is in how they're governed, because they're a hybrid between a nonprofit and a public institution, but they still operate as a public governing body. They have to meet open meeting law and all those requirements. And the other areas in some areas in personnel areas. But the mandates have been adding up over the years to the point that that's one of the issues that charter schools are facing, is that the autonomy bargain has not been kept.
Madam Chair, Mr. Piccolo, what's the cost of open meeting law? What's the cost of, you're a publicly funded organization, what's the cost of having the, your meetings? I don't understand how the open meeting law is a cost driver.
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Dadney, it is a cost just like it is for traditional public schools and any other governmental body in terms of publication of things and so forth. That is not the biggest driver. I mean, that's a small example. The biggest things are around curriculum, testing, mandates for different plans that you have to have for different things. The state has now proposed, for example, just this past week, that charter schools would come under integration and desegregation laws, which have been exempt from for the last 24 years. That would require a whole new set of plans that every charter school has to address and a whole series of other mandates that are part of that. I mean, those costs just continue to add up.
Representative Dabney.
We can have further conversation at another time. For Representative Bly, one last question. What are the statutory outcomes in the small schools funding? There's been a lot of conversation in this committee about we want to examine particularly categorical aids and look to see whether they're effective, whether they're actually delivering results for the intention behind them. Can you clarify for the committee what are the statutory outcomes for the small schools funding stream and how we would test whether this made a positive impact for charter school students or not?
Well,
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure if I can answer that question directly, but I actually have more knowledge of these two schools than the two directors because my history in Northfield goes back further. And I can tell you, and also to comment on the line of questioning that you had as well, is that I know of students who I have referred to these schools that because the schools have very different pedagogy and a very different approach than the traditional school, they do serve students who otherwise struggle in very positive ways. And as I said, our community is proud of the schools. I think that that's a measure of how well they do. And Northfield would be weakened not to have the option to have these kinds of pedagogy in our school district. And I am happy that they're there. That doesn't necessarily answer your more direct question about the outcomes and how we are looking at that. But I can tell you firsthand that as I observe these, I know of children who have greatly benefited from having this option, having this this other kind of pedagogy in our district.
Madam Chair,
Representative Dabney.
Representative Bly, I'm not at all questioning the value of these schools in the community, the values of the schools to the specific students enrolled in them. Maybe I'll shift to Mr. Piccolo. Can you identify for us, as the policy wonk, what are the statutory outcomes for small schools aid that would allow us then to test 5 years from now whether putting this into law, if that so happens, has delivered better academic performance or whatever the measures are, has met the measures in the small schools funding stream statute? Can you help me with that?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I don't know that there are specific requirements under small school revenue. I think the best would be to look at the districts that are currently getting it and see what measurements they're using, because we would have to meet those requirements if this would be enacted in terms of outcomes.
Representative Dabney.
So there aren't any outcomes in the small schools aid? Is that what you're saying, Mr. Piccolo?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I don't know that there's any specific other than all the other requirements that schools are required to do that are just tied specifically to small school aid.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Dabney,
Mr. Piccolo, the small schools are required to meet all the same obligations as larger school districts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a funding stream to help them do that without any outcomes?
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, and Representative Dabney. The concept of small school aid that was adopted by this legislature was to recognize that the cost of doing those things is higher in small schools than in bigger schools, because the cost of those things can be spread over more students in bigger institutions than they can in smaller schools. And so to help them address those requirements, that's what small school aid was put in by this legislature to do.
And Mr. Strom, I'm going to ask you, you know, we have a number of dedicated streams, compensatory aid, integration revenue, others. Could you, if you know this off the top of your head, but just do a quick rundown of any of those that have sort of a requirement to measure results based upon the funding streams, those individual funding streams?
Madam Chair, members, in the general education program, most of those monies are undesignated and come without restrictions. There are others, like compensatory and operating capital, where there are restrictions on how the money is used and essentially fund requirements, account requirements for those. I'm not aware that any of the general education revenue provisions require a report about the outcomes related to those monies. The integration formula that passed 2 years ago, which is outside of general education revenue, does require essentially a report that keys off of the funding. That said, the world's best workforce language from 2 years ago is tied into the overall view, but not in a manner such that funding at this point in time is directly tied to one's reporting under that.
Thank you. I think that maybe gives a little clarity to the discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a fiscal question on the spreadsheet that Ms. Johnson or Mr. Strom. As I'm reading this, if we adopt House File 557, we would need over $1.3 million more budgeted for the small schools' purposes, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, small schools is part of general education aid. So in terms of its aid flow, it would be directly out of the general fund. That's an open and standing appropriation. But for purposes of the legislative budgeting, that would come out of the K-12 target and would be part of the K-12 spending over base that's a part of that target.
And Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, then we would either need to have more money in the small schools revenue, or we would have to divide the $16.5 million up between more schools.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, it works as an entitlement. So in my way of thinking about this, this is any dollar you'd spend would face the same situation here, that it's going to have to fall under your target. But it would not impact, it would be the same as putting a dollar on the formula or putting a dollar in special education. Wherever that money goes above base, this committee essentially will need to do so under its target. It'll make trade-offs about where it's applying that additional spending under the target. But in terms of an impact, because of the way that this is written, it would not result in a decrease in the small schools revenue to any other district. It would come on top of that, and if it were included, this committee would need to fund that as part of its target.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. And then the sub-things that are under there, it's just the way the money is now divided and how it would happen if the new $1.4 million was put in.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the printout shows the current distribution in the first, in the third and fourth columns of who's getting the small schools current revenue currently, and that goes to school districts with 960 or fewer pupils. There's just one of those in the metropolitan area. So as you look at the top of the worksheet, the Randolph School District, which is down by Representative Bly's area, is the one that has fewer than 960 pupils and counts, qualifies for a little bit of the small schools revenue. And the rest is directed to greater Minnesota because none of the other school districts in the metro area fit that. The last two columns then show what the effect of House File 557 57 is, and you can see as you go up and down that list, for those districts with fewer than 200 pupils in the very first column, they're entitled to the additional revenue through the formula, and you can see the amounts of revenue, expected revenue for them if the pupil unit estimates we're using hold true. So for example, I'm just looking on page 11. At the top of the page there, the Glacier Hills Elementary School has 131 children that they serve. So they would qualify for revenue under this proposal. It would be $24,000 that they'd receive, or an additional $188 per pupil. And then those amounts are summed to the top so that you can see the state total, the metro, and the non-metro distributions for those.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask the school leaders a question about special education. Sir, you mentioned that you have 35 to 40% special education.
Correct.
Mr. Raminga.
How are you paying for that in the terms of a cross-subsidy or additional dollars? Where are those coming from? Out of your general fund?
Mr. Raminga.
For a charter school, we're a non-resident district, so we still get state funding, so the state special education aid, and then the remainder of that with some excess cost aid subtracted off is through tuition billing to the resident district.
Okay, and what percentage of your, thank you, Madam Chair, what percentage are you having to do school district tuition reimbursement?
Sure.
Do you know?
Madam Chair, I don't know, and that I have that percentage off the top of my head, no.
That's a tough question.
Sorry.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Mr. Strom, because there were some changes made. So is the new formula now phased in for special education revenue? Because I'm reading in the book that you prepared for us that for 14 and 15, the new formula is being phased in and combines elements of the cost-based special education aid formula with a cross-subsidy reduction. Is that now in effect?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, fiscal year 15 is still a transition year, so next year, the 15-16 school year will look even more different for school districts and charter schools, as there's under the new formula that was adopted, there'll be pupil-based information, pupil-based financing, as well as essentially a hold harmless that's based on cost. The other big change for charter schools on special education is that up until last year, unreimbursed costs for the special ed program for charter schools were all billed back to the resident district as they are under open enrollment. And with the change 2 years ago, now only 90% of the unreimbursed costs will be billed back. So that'll even with the new special education formula comes with a higher level of funding, but for charter schools that serve special education students, not primarily, but because there's some exceptions if you serve entirely special education students, but those districts now on the excess cost, the part that's not funded from the state, 90% of that will be billed back instead of 100%.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Strom, because that's important for us to note when it comes to our charter school population as well as our district populations that change, and but it particularly will affect our charter schools. So thank you for giving us that update.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know to whom I should be addressing this question, possibly Mr. Strom. For the small school revenue, it's for districts that have less than 960 students. And I saw the formula, it's rather complicated. But if you could look on page 8 of the handout, District 2906, Red Lake County Central, has 395 small school pupils. They get $128,000. New Spirit School, which I assume is possibly a charter, is that a small school?
Mr. Strong.
Which number is New Spirit?
That's 4029. So I'm looking at...
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they get nothing.
Yeah.
It's 200 instead of 960, but Red Lake County Central has 395 and they're getting 128,000. So I don't understand where the 200 comes in and the 960 comes in.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative... Newton, the formula for school districts specifically excluded charter schools. So it only, when it was adopted, it only applies to school districts that are small. And there's and the limit when it was passed was a round number of 1,000 pupils, but then the adjustment to the pupil weightings caused that to convert to 960. So if you have more than 960 students, anyone in that small school pupil column that has more than 960 pupils should be receiving zero revenue under that. And as you have less than 960 pupils, you get a portion of the $544 per pupil. So the districts like the one you're referring to, the Red Lake County Central District, that district is going to have a pupil count that qualifies it for revenue. The charter schools were excluded, and what House File 557 does is put in place a system that's similar but uses a much different breakpoint. It uses 200 pupils instead of the 960. So any charter school with more than 200 pupils would not qualify for funding under Representative Bly's bill. And instead, so it's about it. It's at a different level, and that's why the schools of the same size, one would qualify because it's in the district formula, and one would be disqualified because it's above the level that was chosen for the charter school portion of the program.
Thank you, Mr. Strom, and Madam Chair, if I may continue with Representative Bly, why did you settle on a number of 200 instead of 960 for charter schools?
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. Again, I'm going to have to defer to Mr. Piccolo because he's the one who made that judgment, and he can explain his thought better than I can.
Mr. Piccolo.
Madam Chair, Representative, the rationale for the 200 was looking at the number of districts in traditional districts that get small school funding is about 45% of the school district. So we looked at different formulas, and one was If you use the 960 number for traditional districts, all but six charter schools in the state of Minnesota would get small school revenue, because the average charter school is 300 students in the state, and we thought that is not equitable from the other side. And so we looked at different formulas, and if you take the number of school districts that are eligible for small school aid and apply that to charter schools in terms of percentage of districts, it came out to 200 students as the cutoff for enrollment to qualify for small school aid.
Madam Chair, just a comment. I feel, Mr. Piccolo, I understand what you're doing, but long after I'm gone from the legislature, I'm sure the fairness issue will come up and we'll say, why aren't charters getting the same as small schools? And we're using the 1,000 or 960 formula. And then you will have the disparity of more charter schools receiving money than the normal public schools.
Mr. Piccolo?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the rationale again is that in terms of equity and disparity, right now, if you use the 960, as they say, all charter schools except six of them in the state of Minnesota would qualify. So that's a differential disparity the other way. And so to use the same percentage of districts that qualify seemed to be the fairest way of doing it. And you have to understand that charter schools on the whole are smaller than average districts. As I say, this year, for the first time, the average charter school is 300 students. 10 years ago, it was 160 students, the average charter school. So that's the rationale for it, to bring some parity in terms of what districts get and what charter schools get.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And stepping back to the question, line of questioning that Representative Erickson had with Mr. Strom, and referencing back to the discussion when you were presenting, where it had the 90-10, and then it had an ambiguous reference to revenue in a district, is that muddied anymore by this bill and charters?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, no, this bill does not impact any other funding for the charter schools or for the school districts. This bill is entirely separate from our special education and our general ed funding system for everyone else. It would simply add a new component and that would be on top of the existing levels of funding.
Any other questions from members? Is there any member from the audience who wishes to testify on Representative Bly's bill? All right, we'll see any. Representative Bly, any closing comments you'd like to make?
Just thank you for your time. And we're running short on time, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bly, and I renew my motion, and again, but with the intention of laying the bill over. Thank you very much. We appreciate your time today. And Representative Lincheski. Perhaps we saved the best for last. Thank you for your patience. And I'm going to ask Representative Fenton if you want to take the chair.
Thank you. The chair would now like to bring HF 548 before the committee. And the chair moves that HF 548 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, but it will be the chair's intention to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. So the chair now recognizes Representative Lincheski to explain the bill and to introduce the testifiers to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Fenton and Chair Loon. I appreciate so much getting this hearing, and I want to first thank Mr. Withers for getting this worked out on the schedule, and I apologize, we caused a little difficulty in getting the schedule, and I really appreciate your accommodation. So Chair Fenton, Chair Loon, and committee members, thank you so much for hearing this bill. We were here last year, or maybe it was 2 years ago, with The Works, which is located in Bloomington, and I'm going to let the testifiers tell you about The Works. If you don't already know about it, I hope you will take a look at the purple envelope that's in your packet. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jill Mazels. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
And I am CEO of The Works Museum in Bloomington, Minnesota, and indeed we were here last year, so thank you for the opportunity to come back again. At the Works Museum, our mission is to inspire the next generation of innovators, engineers, and creative problem solvers. And yes, we are a museum that focuses on STEM, but our unique area is the focus in elementary engineering. So we meet our mission by bringing engaging and inspiring engineering experiences to children in the elementary years, so kindergarten through grade six primarily. We know that not all children will grow up to be engineers, and that is not our intent at the museum. Our intent and purpose is to really develop kids' skills that they need, life skills, persistence, collaboration, creative problem solving. We hear from employers across the state of Minnesota that is really those are the skills that they are most seeking in employees. We were so grateful to receive our appropriation last year, and we did two primary things with that money. One of them is we really needed to enhance our learning spaces for the children that we serve. We serve approximately 30,000 children a year from 89 different communities, so from Twin Cities metro area and greater Minnesota as well. And it was really important to us to really create more conducive and functional learning spaces that let us teach our hands-on engineering programs to students. The other thing that we are currently in the process of doing and finishing with the state funding is really looking at our exhibits. A lot of them are old and outdated, and we really needed to refine and improve those exhibits to reflect where science, technology, engineering, and math are today, and that is the work we are doing right now with a few of our exhibits, certainly not all, but a few of them. That's what really has launched us into, the state funding really was able to launch us into doing this work. I'm here to request today, the request for this appropriation is to continue this work. We've heard from our community that the one thing they value in us the most and the one thing that they come to us for, so the teachers that we serve and all the children and the families are really our programs and our exhibits. So with this phase one, as we called it, enhancing our learning spaces and our exhibits, was just the tip of the iceberg. We have many more exhibits that we want to create and refine to reflect where the world is today. So, for example, one of the things that wasn't around when we opened about 20 years ago was coding and coding for kids. And we know, because we've offered a camp and programs for kids in coding, it is in high demand. We sell out those programs faster than we can offer them. And so we need our exhibits and our programs to be relevant and incorporating the technologies today that the students of today will need in their careers tomorrow. The other thing that we do is we not only serve our community on-site, but we do serve greater Minnesota. We go off-site as well, and we serve about 10,000 students throughout Minnesota. So we take what we do on-site, and we leverage it, and we deliver it off-site through classrooms and also through our family engineering night programs where we engage parents and families together. We know it's really important to get the parent involved in their child's education. And a lot of times at these events, the parents have no idea how engaged their kids are in these activities that we're doing. So it's like an aha moment for them, and we really help them become inspired to support their children's learning. The other thing, the last thing the state appropriation has really done for us is really help leverage the other contributed revenue that we raise. So we get money from our corporate donors, from foundations, and from individuals, and they have really seen the investment as a state as like an approval. And so that has really boosted our ability to grow our contributed revenue. You may wonder, you know, how are we unique? I know you hear other museums come up here, and we're all asking for your support. But we're unique for a couple different reasons. We're unique because we really are one of the very few institutions that focus on that elementary age student. Again, like I said, we focus on children in K through 6. And the other unique quality to us is that our focus is really elementary engineering. We are one of the few museums in the country that have that focus. You know, we feel that is our true niche, and that is where our experience lies. And that's what really differentiates us from all of our colleagues and other museums out there. And we know, based on research, that student interest in STEM particularly is at about the 57% range when they're in grade school, and that drops significantly to about 30% of the students as they reach middle school and high school. So we are that beginning of that really critical pipeline when kids are forming their academic interests in STEM. And if we can keep them engaged through elementary school, that just gives them more benefit and more inspiration to continue that STEM education into middle school, high school, and beyond into the future workforce. And we know, as in Minnesota, by the year 2020, STEM jobs are going to increase by 18%. And that is all areas of the workforce, from manufacturing to management. All those STEM fields are growing, and we are really the inspiration, and we really feel that we're that first point of engagement for those kids to be able to take those jobs into the future. So in conclusion, we look forward to continuing to partner with the state of Minnesota, and your support will help us broaden and deepen the impact for all the children that we serve throughout the state. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Mazels. Would our next testifier please state your name?
My name is Brenda Rainey. I'm the Director of Development at the Works Museum. And I'm here to answer questions.
Thank you, and I see that we do have some questions from members, so I will start with Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. Your exhibits, how many of those do you produce yourself, or do you go out and purchase any exhibits, like from the Minnesota Science Museum? I know they manufacture exhibits for other museums.
Yeah.
And secondly, are we all going to get to play with this
today? You are.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Ms. Mazel.
Madam Chair, Representative. You know, the Works is, we're on a much smaller scale than the Science Museum. We actually have produced, so when the museum got started, it was really the founder, who I took over for 3 years ago, and really volunteer engineers that produced our exhibits. Since then, we've produced one of our own exhibits. We do work, most of our exhibits are produced with our staff and volunteers that we use. We're not as formal with as the Science Museum because we just don't have that resource base. We also do use products that we purchase. And we, for example, just purchased a building product, rather new product, that's full of boards and pulleys and cranes that kids can use to build. So it's a little bit a combination of both. And yes, these are our sound sandwiches. And this, what you all have in your packet, is this is an activity that the kids build when they get to when they're studying sound, and you can kind of play it like a kazoo. So this is a little takeaway for all of you.
Representative,
got it.
Thank you. Next, we have Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I love your museum too. When my grandson comes from California, we hit all the museums, and so I think Representative Lencheski knows that I really do like museums, but not just because of that. But, you know, you have this fabulous membership, and I know families that frequent because of that membership. So to what extent does this really reasonable family membership affect, you know, your costs? Because $70 for this, you know, a family is just unbelievable.
Yeah. Ms. Mazel? Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, it really is a modest cost for our membership. And we have about 600, 650 members right now. And that cost for us, we keep it where it is because, one, we want to remain competitive because we want to sell memberships. And the other thing that membership really does for our museum is it gives our members discounts to our programs.
Yes.
And that really is what our visitors, I think, value in us the most. And that's how we, you know, and those programs are fee-based, so the cost of the membership, they get a discount, but we also secure that revenue from program fees.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Fenton. Talk a little bit about what you offer homeschool families, because that's also very intriguing.
Ms. Mazel. Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. Yes, we do serve homeschool families. So about two Mondays or so a month, we do programming specifically for homeschool families. So because they're not part of a big school group that comes in, what we do is we have a morning set aside where the families come in and they explore the museum, and then they get an opportunity to take a class like school group classes do. So all the families that are there together combine to make a class. The unique thing about the homeschool families is you're working with multi-age groups. So you may be working with a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 10-year-old. But the experience of our educators, they handle that.
Representative
Madam Chair and members, it's fabulous. So I mean, it's really great. I wish we had money that we could help all these, but I know we have limited sources. But thank you so much for what you do and provide for our children and our families. That's so important.
Thank you. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to say it's wonderful to see the works here. You were in a different location many years ago, and my children were small, and we spent a lot of time there, and it's absolutely incredible. I had just a couple of questions. Obviously, you're very cutting edge with what you're doing, but I'm wondering how you gather feedback to improve your programming, and maybe I'll just ask my second question because it's related. I was just wondering, I was looking through your materials, and I might have missed it, but I'm wondering if you have any type of collaborations with other organizations like the Science Museum.
Yeah. Ms. Mazel.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, your first question was on gathering audience feedback. So we do a couple different things. About a year ago, we just did a visitor survey, which is basically, why do you come to us? What do you value in us? What type of exhibits do you want to see? So we get a lot of work from surveys. And we're also starting what we're calling community conversations, where we're going out to different groups in the communities, educators, members, donors, community partners, on what they want from the organization and where their needs are the greatest, because we really want to become an organization that serves the need of the community. So both through conversations and some survey work. We're doing a member survey right now to find out what our members want from us so we can create a strong program for them. And your second question, if you could repeat that?
Right. I was wondering if you work in collaboration with any other organizations.
Yes, we absolutely do. So we have several partnerships that we do. We're part of the Minnesota STEM Network, and so we work as part of that. We also have partnerships with, we're doing a program with several small museums called the STEM Pathways Program, which is us and the Bakken and the Science Museum and the Minnesota Zoo, where we're looking at a continuum of delivering STEM education, and we're students taking a different grade. We also partner with universities, so we've had a few different partnerships with the University of St. Thomas, their School of Engineering, as well as with the University of Minnesota over the years.
Representative Seltzer?
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucheski, for bringing this forward. We funded this and the Headwaters, Representative Purcell's bill, for the first time last year, and I think legislators, we can see why. I mean, the programs are very effective, and you're dealing with STEM, which is so important. But probably also the main premise of the funding in the past is just the realization that students can have wonderful educational experiences outside of the traditional four walls of the classroom. And I think that's really important, and the more we can do that, the better it's going to be at meeting all of our goals of student performance and closing the achievement gap and all of that. So thank you for what you're doing. Thank you, Representative Lucheski, for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And could the testifier please tell me about your total operating budget?
Sure.
Ms. Mazzell.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, our total operating budget for our current fiscal year is about $1.6 million. We've seen exponential growth over the past 5 years, both in our budget and in our attendance numbers. So about 5 years ago, we were at about 30,000 visitors and a $500,000 budget, and now we're at about $75,000 and a $1.5 million budget.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Is Mazzell's?
Mazzell's, yes.
You're asking for $100,000 for fiscal year 2016 and 2017.
Correct.
Ms. Mazzell.
What will that do? What will you do with that money specifically?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, so specifically we will continue the work that we have started with this other appropriation. So specifically we will work, that will allow us to redevelop several more exhibits. We were able to redevelop a couple exhibits with that initial $75,000, and we also used some of those dollars to enhance our learning spaces, so our classrooms. But primarily with the $100,000, you know, we have about between 25 and 30 exhibits, so we have a significant amount of work that we need to do to renovate and bring in current technologies to our exhibits. We would also use some of those dollars and leverage the content from the exhibits and incorporate that into our programs, both for our school groups and our summer camp programs, both on-site and off-site, specifically do with those dollars.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mullery?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First, really simple one. Is this the one that Peggy Lepick's always pushing on?
Ms. Mazzell.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, yes, it is.
Okay. Madam Chair, second question.
Representative Mullery.
Are you going to become politically correct and put the A in STEM into STEAM?
Ms. Mazzell.
Madam
it's
Chair,
not just politically correct, it's educationally correct, according to a lot of the experts.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, fantastic question. You know, we don't, when we talk about that, we're about STEM, but truly our focus and what we are incorporating into engineering is engineering and design, and that design component is really about art as well. And one of the things that we really want to do within our space is incorporate more art and more artwork, especially kinetic sculpture. We have a fantastic kinetic sculpture built out of Kinex pieces in the museum, and we really want to incorporate more of that into the works.
Representative Mullery?
No further.
Thank you. Representative Loon?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucheski, for bringing this forward. I'm really interested in what Ms. Mazzell's commented on, and it's in your materials, about kind of the drop-off and interest in the STEM area. And so I'm just wondering, of the visitors that you get, I'm assuming you get a lot of field trips in that, but is it primarily the younger elementary students, or are you seeing still, especially like junior high age, 6th grade through 8th grade, that you're getting students in the door? And what are you doing differently with exhibits or other things to try to attract and hold the attention and the interest of those students?
Ms. Mazzal.
Madam Chair, Representative Loon. As I stated previously, our focus truly is that elementary age group. I would say the majority of school groups that we get are 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th graders. We do a little bit of work with middle schoolers, and one area specifically is in our summer camp program. We do Lego robotics for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders because we know that is a big area of interest for them. The other thing that we're going to be offering this fall is a program where we want to focus on engineering and girls in engineering. And our intention is to work with middle school and high schoolers to mentor the younger kids and have those middle school and high school students serve as role models for the younger kids.
Ms. Rainey?
Madam Chair, Representative, I could just add also, we do align all of our school-based programs with Minnesota State Science Standards, so teachers are able to very easily identify which programs tie to what they're teaching in the classroom, bring their student to the works for that hands-on experience that they tell us is far more effective with certain science standards in helping the students understand.
Representative Bloom?
Thank you. Thank you for your responses.
Last question we have here is Representative Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the testimony. I just had a quick question kind of stemming off of Representative Murphy's question about the budget. And I noticed in your handout it says that one of your success indicators is paying off debt obligations. So I was just kind of curious about that. How much debt is remaining? How much of your annual budget is dedicated towards paying off that debt? Mm-hmm. And if you were to get this appropriation in the bill, how much of that would go towards the debt, or would that appropriation just go towards programming? Sorry, that's a lot in one question, but hopefully.
Ms. Mazzals.
Madam Chair, Representative. So that debt is, 3 years ago we purchased the current building that we're in, and that debt is the mortgage on the building. Right now it's probably at about $1.2 to $1.3 million, which is about 10% of our operating budget. And the funds from the state, both the current appropriation that we have and the appropriation request that we're asking for, none of that goes to pay off this debt. This appropriation dollars are put into a restricted account specifically for this exhibit and programmatic work.
Representative Wells?
Wonderful. Thank you. You did an excellent job summing that all up. And I appreciate that the appropriation wouldn't be going towards the debt, but I also appreciate that you're dedicated to making sure that gets paid off. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody here from the audience that wishes to briefly testify? Hearing no further witnesses, is there any further discussion on House File 548? With that, I'm going to turn it back over. Representative Lincheski, would you like to make some closing comments on your bill?
Thank you, Chair Fenton. Just I want to thank the committee not only for last year's support, but I want to thank Chair Loon for hearing this bill, and I really appreciate the time this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. Hearing no further discussion, the chair lays over House File 548 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later date. Thank you, Representative Lincheski. The committee is now adjourned.